Good morning. It's good to see all of you here. Always enjoy the time we have to be together and enjoy the effort that is put in to make our worship not only happen, but be very edifying. And I appreciate everyone participating and just the encouragement that this gives us, but also previous to this, the classes and the effort that goes into those. We're thankful to all the teachers there and for the encouragement they give. And so I hope that I can help that continue in what I want to talk about this morning. As you know, we've talked a lot about what God determined to do in Christ. We talked about the idea in the Old Testament of pouring out His Spirit and how that was all connected with the coming of Christ and the wondrous blessings and things that would come at that time to the not only the Jews, but to everyone that was going to be poured out to everyone. Well, we've talked a lot about the nature of that and the church and all the things that the blessings that have come. But I want to kind of look a little bit into the future today and talk about something else in connection with Christ. And it's a subject that's associated with this, but with instead the second coming of Christ. What I want to talk about in particular is the idea of the times and seasons of Christ's return. Now you may wonder why I would talk about this, but the truth is, folks, this is on the minds of most of the people you see in the religious world today. It is a simple fact that end time predictions, you may even say speculations at times, under the idea of biblical interpretation continues to be one of the most popular things that people do today. I mean, there are churches throughout this town, throughout this state, in this country and the world that continually predict the end of time or when Christ will return and set up His kingdom. Maybe not would say the end of time per se, but the return of Christ and the setting up of His millennial kingdom is a common idea in the religious world. And there has been just untold number of predictions made in connection with that. Very prominent church began in the 1800s. And at that time, mid to late 1800s, they began predicting that the end of the gospel age and the beginning, and Christ's return and the beginning of the establishment of the millennial kingdom would happen in 1914. And they had all kinds of, they had various formulas, things that they, or various aspects of this formula that they used to come to this conclusion. And they predicted it for some 30-something to 40-something years, that 1914 was the day. Well, as you know, that didn't happen. In 1914, that year rolled around and the people of that particular group sold all their possessions, oftentimes gathering together on rooftops and things, waiting for the Lord's return. And of course, He did not return. And from that time forward, they predicted again the end of time, the return of Christ, all in connection with the signs, the times and the seasons supposedly being able to be read by them. And they predicted it some 9 other times. And the last time that they predicted this was 1974. Well, as you can see, none of those came true. We're still here. Time, the Lord has not returned. And this idea of the millennial kingdom has never happened. They, of course, do not predict that any longer. They quit doing that. But amazingly, people still file into this particular religious group. They join it all the time. And they do so despite the fact that God is very clear about false prophecy. He's very clear about the nature of it and what God thinks about it. And He's always been that way. You can go back as far as the Old Testament, Deuteronomy chapter 18. Verses 21 and 22, here the Lord said, "And if you say in your heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, That is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. And let me just say, there's been a multitude of other groups that have sought to predict the end of, you might say, the gospel age that we're living in today, as they would put it, and the return of Christ. And these have all basically failed, just miserably failed in their predictions, because as you can see, we are still here. One group predicted that the Lord would return, and when he did not return and set up his temple here upon the earth, they said, well, they actually got the prediction right. They just got some of the details wrong, that actually he was entering into the spiritual temple, the true temple of heaven, rather than returning to earth. Well, I'm sorry, that may justify it to some people, but the fact is that's still a false prophecy, because they said he was coming to earth and that he was going to be, you know, return and set up his kingdom and the temple here upon the earth. And yet that has been the common direction that you see happening in connection with people predicting the times and seasons of the Lord's return. When it doesn't happen, they spin that, they turn that around and say, well, really, we were right. We just got this part wrong, and so don't reject what we're saying. It is much like the book, many of you probably weren't alive when that, some of you weren't, or at least too young to remember, the book 88 Reasons the Lord Will Return in 1988, which was followed by 89 Reasons the Lord Will Return in 1989. That was actually two different books published those during those times. And of course, neither one were true. But everybody was sure it was true because he was a NASA scientist that wrote that. Well, that doesn't mean anything. And I guess people realized that with the exciting sequel failing as well. But the point that I want to make about this is that with all of these situations, whether it's a religious organization or church or individual, they're all claiming that God has revealed signs within the Bible for us to be able to know the times and the seasons of Christ's return. And so they claim to be able to read those signs, to know what they are, and thus predict the general time that the Lord will return in some particular year or whatever it may be. And when you hear their particular theories, they do sound convincing. They sound even logical at times when you hear them use certain scripture and I might say certain assumptions that are necessary for those theories to take place or to be real. They sound very logical when you hear them. And I understand why people may believe them to be true. But the thing is, it doesn't really matter which particular theory you pick. It all comes down to this idea that they believe God has revealed, whether in the Old Testament or the New Testament, certain signs, certain things that we can look at and to therefore determine by, you know, combining these with other scriptures and thoughts to really ultimately determine the time of the Lord's return. So the question that I want to look at this morning is, related to this title here concerning the times and seasons, and that is, has God actually revealed for us knowledge in which we can determine the times and seasons of Christ's return? That's a question I want to address this morning and hopefully address it from a biblical standpoint. And I want to do it by just answering some questions in connection with this. And the first question that I want to look at this morning is, why must we talk about times and seasons? Why do I use those terms? Well, there's a reason why I do that. And, you know, when you're talking about times and seasons, that's different in people's minds than other terminology found within the Scriptures, because the Scriptures are very clear that we cannot know the day nor hour of Christ's return. That is clearly taught within Scripture without any question. In such passages as Matthew chapter 25 and verse 13, this is the conclusion of Jesus' parable about the 10 virgins. And this is what Jesus said. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. That's the point that's made there. You don't know the day, you don't know the hour. Also in Luke chapter 12, verses 35 through 40, here Jesus is giving, you might say, a parable, an illustration, whatever. And his point is for his disciples to be prepared at any time for his coming, and you'll see why. He says, beginning in verse 35, "Let your waist be girded and your light lamps burning, and you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, and when he comes and knocks, that they may open to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. And if he should come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants. But know this, if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect." And so Jesus is quite clear in these instructions that he's coming in a day and an hour that they do not expect, that they're not going to be able to know. And yet, when we read that language, it seems to me kind of like an open and shut case. When we hear that kind of language, we say, well, okay, the day of the Lord is unpredictable, and therefore that's the end of that. But that's not the case with the religious world or with those who hold to the premillennial idea and doctrine. Because premillennialists, and understand, they claim that we can't know the day nor the hour, but we can know the times and the seasons of Christ's return. They make a distinction in the two. They say that the Bible teaches that we, you know, can't know the specifics. And I'll say that again in just a minute, make that point again. But we can't know the specific day, the specific hour, but we can know the general time or seasons of Christ's return. And so when you see that in their thinking, you begin to understand then why we have to talk about times and seasons. Because they make a distinction and say, well, yes, you can't know that day, you can't know that hour, but that's not talking about the general, you know, time in which we can determine that Christ is going to come. And so, they make a distinction. But I want to ask, if this distinction were true, are there any issues related to that? And the answer to that is yes. And I see it just in the passages that we've looked at so far. Because although this distinction may seem reasonable on the surface, if this distinction is valid, then we have to then reason from that, that Christ's warning in Luke 12 actually didn't apply to the people he was warning at all. You may say, well, how can you say that? Well, understand, in Luke chapter 12, Jesus is warning his disciples to be ready always, isn't he? Because you don't know when I'm going to come. That's what he says. He says day and hour, or he says hour there, but his point is you always be ready. Well, here's the problem. The problem is simply this. If Christ has also, and knowingly going, he knew this at the time, if he was going to reveal signs that people could look at to determine when he was going to return, and obviously none of those signs existed at that time because it's been 2,000 years, basically, since he made that warning, correct? He warned them right then and there, you be ready at all times because you don't know the day and hour that I'm coming. Well, folks, if he's going to reveal signs that show when he's coming, well, he would have known there are no signs right now of my coming. I mean, obviously, because it's been 2,000 years since. And so the truth is, in the absence of those signs that are supposedly pointing to his return, they would easily know right then and there, as Jesus would, that that kind of warning right then didn't apply to them at all. Because he wasn't coming. There were no signs. Nothing that they could see that would point to his return. But the second thing is this. If Jesus revealed the signs to tell of the times and seasons or the general time frame of His return, then why would Jesus tell them to be ready at all times because He would come when they do not expect it, at a day and an hour that they do not expect it? Because think about it. What were these signs supposed to do? They're supposed to point to when He's coming so that they would expect His return. And it's very interesting that He uses the language of the example of a thief. He says, if a man knew that a thief was coming, he would wait up and be ready for him no matter when, what day, what hour he came, right? Well, folks, think about it. If you knew a thief would tell you, and he says, hey, I'm coming in the fall, and I'm going to steal everything you've got. I'm going to wreck your house. Your life's going to be done for when I'm done, and I'm coming in the fall. Let me ask you, are you going to be ready for that thief no matter what day or what hour he comes? Well, of course you are. You're going to do that, see? And so if the signs of Jesus tell us what season, what time to look for Him, then why would Jesus tell them, be ready always because you're going to come at a time you don't expect, when the very signs would point to the time to expect? See, there are just issues with that kind of thinking in connection with these verses. And so as we look at this, we see real issues coming about when you begin to try to interpret the Lord's warnings with the current premillennial kind of approach to these passages. But with that said, let's talk about times and seasons in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. There is a reason why people want to make this distinction. And it comes in connection with 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Because they believe that this particular chapter in the first two verses make a distinction between times and seasons and the hour. And you can know one without the other. And so let's read 1 Thessalonians 5 verses 1 and 2. And I want you to notice what is said in this passage. It says, now remember, let me say this. Remember, as was read this morning, he's just talked about the return of Christ in chapter 4. And so he concludes then, or turns the subject in chapter 5 to this. But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. Now, to understand why this passage is so important is that those who hold to the idea that there are signs that point out the times and the seasons, they claim that this passage is saying that Paul did not have to write to these brethren about times and seasons because they already knew the signs. They already knew the times and seasons of Christ, what to look for, so he didn't have to write to them about this. They already had full knowledge of these signs that were necessary to be viewed in order to determine when the Lord will return. And they would also say, in addition to this knowledge, it is claimed that they knew that the particular day and hour, however, could not be determined. And so they say, Paul's making the distinction in the two. He's saying, you can know the times and the seasons, the general term, time frame of Christ's return, but you can't know the day or the hour, which is the specific, you know, of the specifics of those of that return and when that day, when that hour will be. And so this is the general view that people take about this passage. And the reason I know that is because in talking with a man about this particular issue, when I pointed out where Jesus said, you can't know the day or the hour, he said, oh, but 1 Thessalonians 5 says you can know the times and the seasons. Well, there are questions relating to this particular interpretation, and I want to ask, are there problems? Well, again, there are. And the reason for that, first of all, and folks, this is what we have to be very careful about when we're studying the Scriptures with anyone, with ourselves, whatever is, we've got to look at what the passage says and not teach any more than what it says and only what it says. And the truth is, The passage doesn't say that they knew anything about signs or times and seasons of Christ's return. It doesn't say that. All it says is, Paul says, I don't even have to write to you about that. That's all it says. But it also goes on and says that the one thing they did know, however, and this is interesting because they assumed they knew about the times and seasons, but Paul doesn't say that, but he does say what they did know, and they did know that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. And let me tell you, those two ideas are very different. The idea that they knew signs and things like that that would point to the times and seasons, that's a very different knowledge. And it is assumed in the passage than what he actually says they knew, which was that the Lord would return, that his return would be like a thief in the night. But the second problem with this particular view of this passage is it ignores Paul's reason as to why he didn't have to write about the times and the seasons. And of course, as you look at this passage, it becomes quite clear why Paul did not. And the reason is because or for the very fact that they knew well that Christ's coming would be like a thief in the night. And so Paul's saying, I don't have to write to you about times and seasons of Christ's return because you know quite well that the day of the Lord will come, or that the day of the Lord's return will come like a thief in the night. So what was Paul's point? Well, the point is this. Because they knew Christ's return is unpredictable, because it comes like a thief, he says, well then, there was nothing to discuss then about times of seasons. Because if his return is going to be like a thief in the night, then there's nothing to discuss about times and seasons, because I can tell you this, thieves don't tell you the time of the season they're coming to your house. They just don't. I mean, you just don't have thieves calling you up and saying, like I said before, I'm going to rob your house this fall. I'm just telling you that, but it's going to be at a time you don't expect. Well, that's ridiculous. You're going to expect it. You're going to be looking for it in the fall. Thieves don't announce when they are coming. And so, if we understand that, then we understand why he says, there's no reason for me to talk to you about times and seasons of Christ's return, because you know full well that he comes as a thief in the night. It's unpredictable. There's no way to know a time or a season or anything like that, because he's just going to be like a thief and come when you don't expect it. And so, there is the issues relating with this passage to interpret it, I think, again, as often is done by those who are trying to say we can know the times and seasons, makes the passage kind of nonsensical in that it abuses the very things that are revealed there. But let's look at another question then. We have to ask, well then, why do premillennialists, those who would dispensationalists, why do they insist that Christ has revealed times and seasons of His return? Now, we could go into Old Testament and various passages, especially the 70 weeks of Daniel, and it's kind of interesting to look at a lot of the theories, especially if you looked at the theories connected with the 1914 date that was presented there, and I'll just tell you who did that. It was the Jehovah's Witnesses organization were the ones that predicted that, and the Seventh-day Adventists and others have done it as well. But the truth of the matter is, if you looked at their theories of how they came to that conclusion, now they included the 70 weeks of Daniel and a lot of signs and some arbitrary associations of when that time was to begin to be counted and all this, all kinds of assumptions. It's quite ingenious, but of course, as you know, it ingeniously failed. It was not correct. And they tried over and over again to the point that it became so embarrassing to them and they lost so many members that they quit doing that in 1974. That was the last time they did that. But the point is, we'll have to ask them, why do they insist that Christ has revealed the times or seasons of His return? Why? Why do they insist that? Well, it's really, for the most part, especially as far as signs and things concerned, it comes down to this one chapter, Matthew 24. Most people believe that Matthew 24, and it is taught continually, Matthew 24 just lays out in detail all the signs of Christ's return. And you'll hear it all the time. People say, oh, there's wars and rumors of wars right now, nation rising up against nation, and there's famine and all this. And you hear people say, see, the Lord's coming soon. We better be ready. I heard the preacher talk about it Sunday, and I hear that kind of thing all the time. Because of Matthew 24 and all the signs that are listed there. And so as we look at this particular passage, and let me just say, to the vast majority, that view is the truth in their minds. That these are, I mean, most everybody you talk to in the religious world believes Matthew 24 is the chapter. And if you can see those signs, you know then that the Lord is about to return. And yet there are problems. Because the truth of the matter is, in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus is actually listing signs that apply to the destruction of Jerusalem, not to the end of time. He was talking about the destruction of the Jerusalem, the Jewish nation, which would of course be also the end of the age for them. The Jewish age was about to end, and we know this to be the case for several reasons. First of all, if you notice in the beginning of the chapter, Jesus makes a prediction that kind of started all of this. In verse 1, it says, "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, 'Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down.'" So they're showing him all these buildings of the temple, which is the very focus, you know, kind of the heart of Jerusalem, is that temple. And Jesus says to them, "You may have all kinds," you know, they're showing the pride. "Look at this temple." And Jesus says, "It's going to be brought down to nothing. Not one stone will be left on another. It's going to be leveled." And you can imagine what that meant to those disciples. They can't fathom that happening. And so, as a result of that, they asked Jesus some questions, and the signs that he revealed are the result of that question. They asked, beginning in verse 3, it says, "Now as they sat on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?'" So they're asking a question. You know, when's this all going to happen? What will be the sign of your coming? What will be the end of the age? These are three basic questions, but I think often have very much connection with one another in the thinking, especially of the Jew. Because with the destruction of Jerusalem in their mind, this would obviously be the second return of Christ, the end of the age, and all those things. It just, in their mind, that's the way it would be. And so they ask these questions, and so Jesus is responding then to this question. When will these things be? When is this going to be fulfilled? And he begins to list signs at this point. And these signs have to do with, as you've oftentimes heard, he says, there'll be false Christ in verse 5. But people are going to try to deceive you. He says there'll be wars and rumors of wars. You'll hear that. And he says, but the end's not yet. The nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilence, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows, you know. And then he goes on and talks about how you're going to be persecuted. They're going to deliver you up. And then ultimately he says even that and yet the gospel is going to be preached to the whole world before all this happens. And so you can, in reading these passages, obviously, you recognize these points that people oftentimes bring up. Oh, the famine, the pestilence, all the rumors of wars, it's all starting. You ever heard anybody say that kind of thing? Well, boy, I have. It never fails. Every time there's a rumbling in the Middle East or a new war about to start, boy, the premillennialists come out preaching this doctrine of the times and seasons. It's here. We can see it. Here are the signs, and we know this is real. And again, when they put it all together, it sounds so logical. It sounds so believable. But they're just problems. And that is, as we see, as we're going to see without question, Jesus is giving these signs in connection with when will these things be? He tells them, here are the signs. And one of the things that people don't understand is that what Jesus is actually doing, He is revealing these signs to them to warn them so that they can escape the destruction that's coming. This destruction is going to come on Jerusalem, and He wants His disciples to be able to see the signs, to read these signs, so that they can avoid the harm that's going to come upon Jerusalem, so that they're not there, so that they're away from this destruction, and it doesn't happen to them. And someone says, well, how do you know that to be the case? Well, if you look at verses 15 and 16, you begin to see why we know that to be the case. Because number one, as we saw in verses 1 and 2, He says, you know, this is going to happen, and then they ask the question, and He begins to answer it. But then in verse 15 it says, therefore, this is conclusion, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. Well, let me ask you, brother, where's the holy place? Is it not Jerusalem and the temple in that area? That's the holy place, see? He says, when you see that, He says, whoever reads, let him understand. See, I'm warning you here. Verse, therefore, the next verse. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. See, don't do anything in connection. Don't come into Jerusalem. Let him who's in the field not go get his clothes. You know, all of these things. Woe if it's on the Sabbath. Why? Because Jerusalem's doors would be closed. It would be very difficult to get out. In wintertime, very difficult to flee. All of these are issues related to, and I can, again, I want to show you why I know this to be the case, the armies of the Roman Empire coming around Jerusalem, surrounding it to destroy it. Now you say, how do you know that's what He means, the abomination of desolation? Well, the answer is simple. Luke chapter 21 points this out. In verses 20 through 22, this is what Luke had to say. And this is his account of Jesus' warning here. And what does he say? But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. See, the abomination of desolation. The Roman Empire and its filth, its abomination, was also an army of desolation. So, it's coming. So again, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in her midst depart, or in the midst of her depart. And let those who are in the country, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. See, Jesus said it was going to happen. Jerusalem would be surrounded by armies and it would be destroyed. It would be desolated. Because that's what was going to come. And you know what, folks? This took place within 40 years of that speaking. Actually, it took place AD 70. Less than 40 years, it happened. The Romans came in, destroyed Jerusalem. And so, it happened just as was predicted. They leveled the temple. It was over. The nation of Israel was done. Now, are there objections? Yes, there are. Premillennialists say, oh, no, no, no. If you tell people that, oh, no, no, that's not right. And they have their reasons. They say, oh, that can't possibly be right because Jesus spoke Jesus spoke of apocalyptic events happening here. He said the sun was not going to give its light. the moon would be dark and stars would fall from the sky. Folks, this is the end of time. This is the apocalypse. How can you say this is the end of Jerusalem? Well, folks, see, I understand when people have this kind of thing preached to them continually, it all seems so logical. I mean, that sounds sensible, doesn't it? I mean, that sounds like the end of time. But the truth is, people believe this kind of thing because they don't know the Old Testament. They don't know the language of the Old Testament. They don't know events in the Old Testament. And therefore, they can't make the connection here that is necessary to understand what Jesus is talking about. Because the truth is, folks, this is nothing more than just figurative language that is used by God to express great destruction and horror coming upon people that are being judged by Him. You may say, how do I know that? Well, Isaiah does this. In Isaiah chapter 13 and verse 1, it says, the burden upon Babylon through the burden against Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. Now that's what he says. He's talking about this burden that's going to come to Babylon. And you can read down through and see this apocalyptic language, but notice what happens beginning in verse 9. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. And He will destroy its sinners from it, for the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth. The moon will not cause its light to shine. And then in verse 13, notice this language. Therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place, the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in its day of His fear, in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of His fierce anger. Now folks, that sounds like the end of time, doesn't it? I mean, the stars are going to be dark, the earth's going to move out of its place, all that. But folks, that's just common apocalyptic language. Because if you read on down in the rest of the chapter, he talks about how that the Mede army, the Median army, if you want to call it that, I don't know, the people there of the Mede Empire are going to come in and they're going to destroy Babylon. He's going to use them. And that's what he's talking about here. And yet you see the language that is exactly basically the same language God's talking about in destroying in His wrath, in His judgment of Jerusalem. But people say, oh, but wait a minute. Jesus said this would be the time of His coming. He says specifically that He's going to come at this point. He's coming back. This is His second return. And we know that because it says in verse 30, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with great power and great glory. And so we see in verse 29 this darkening of the sun, and then in verse 30 this sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. And they say, see, that's the second coming. There Jesus says, I'm coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Well, folks, again, let me say, when people assume that, they do so because of an ignorance of Old Testament prophecy, apocalyptic language that describes God coming in judgment of a people. And the reason I know that is in Isaiah chapter 19, in verse 1, we see this same idea. And again, the burden against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. The idols of Egypt will totter at His presence, and the heart of Egypt will melt in its midst. Here, and if you read the rest of the chapter, he's talking about this destruction that he's going to bring upon Egypt. And he starts it out by saying how God's going to come on a cloud into Egypt. The very point Jesus just made. And is he coming just to have a look around? No, he's coming to destroy. That's what he's going to do. And so Jesus says, in the same way, and see, these Jews would have easily known these references. He's coming in a cloud too, and his glory and his power will be seen. Yes, Jerusalem may have sought to destroy the Christ by killing him, crucifying him, burying him, but they would one day see his glory and power in the destruction that he brought upon because of their rejection of him. He would be coming in the clouds in judgment upon them, just as God had said he would do in Isaiah chapter 19. But then finally people say, oh, but Jesus said he would send out his angels to collect the elect from all the four winds of the earth and everywhere. Well, surely that is talking about the end of time. Because in verse 31, he says, and he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the heavens, from one end of the heaven to the other. And so here you have language of God sending out angels to gather his elect. Well, obviously that's the end of time. He'd bring them all in, you know, for eternity, or they might say for the entrance into this millennial kingdom. Well, again, problems. And that is because if you notice up until this point, nothing's been literal, has it? There's not a, in this language, it's not literally that the stars are going to fall from heaven and the sun's not going to give us a lot of, this is apocalyptic language. It is describing the vast, you know, amazing things that are going to happen in connection with these events. And they're described so big so that people can see the wondrous nature of them. They're beyond human ability to create and to make happen and must be divine in nature. Well, folks, the same is true of this passage here. Why all of a sudden are we assuming that this is literally, you know, spiritual angels of God collecting the elect in the sense as we would think of in the end of time? Because what I would present to you is this continues to be apocalyptic language. And what we have to understand is that word angel there, do you know what that word means? It actually just means messenger. That's all the term angelos. When you look at that in the Greek, it just means a messenger. That's all the term means. And as you look at this, you can understand then why that's the case, because these were, even in the divine sense, messengers sent out to do the will of God. Whatever he wanted to do, he sent angels to take care of that business. They were God's messengers. But what I present to you is that the passage in this apocalyptic language is actually describing what God's going to do after the destruction of Jerusalem. Once Christ comes in His glory, what's going to happen then is as a result of the destruction of Jerusalem and the Jewish nation. And think about what they had done to the gospel up until this time. They had fought against it. They had persecuted those who tried to teach it. They had imprisoned them, killed them. And now all of a sudden they're going to be dealt with by God. And what's God going to be able to do there through His messengers now? He's going to be able to send them out unhindered throughout the world, and the elect of God can be collected from all places and brought into the kingdom. It's all going to happen now with ease, at least in comparison. And so the messengers of God, which I present to you to be the preachers of the gospel, those who would take this message would go out and they would collect the elect. In other words, the elect are just those chosen of God. And I want you to turn with me to Colossians chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. Understand, we're coming very close to the end. Colossians 2, 13 and 14 kind of puts this all in perspective. Listen to what he says here. He says, but we are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you. That means you're elected. That's who the elect are, the chosen. Chose you for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth. Okay, that's how you're chosen to be an elect. It's through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth, to which He called you, how? By our gospel, for the obtaining of the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. That's how the elect are going to be called. That's how they're going to be gathered, through sanctification and belief in the truth. But that happens through what? The preaching of the gospel. The messengers of the gospel would go out into all the world at that point without any hindrance, because the evil nation of Israel that had fought against the gospel now was gone. But you know what the biggest problem with this whole theory of premillennialism and all their objections is? The next three verses. That's four verses. Chapter 24, beginning in verse 32. And that is simply this. This whole theory that these signs are talking about the end of time just fly right in the face of the plain and simple time frame that Christ revealed for when these events would take place. We know He can't be talking about the end of time because Jesus says clearly, these events will happen during your generation, the one He was talking to right then and there. And how do I know that? Notice beginning again in verse 32. He says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branches have already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. See, He says here, you understand what I'm telling you. I'm giving you the signs. And so just as you can see when summer is near because these fig trees start leaving out, you understand that these things are near when you see these signs. He says, so you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. He says, you got to understand, just as you can tell when the summer's near by the leaves on the fig tree, you can know this destruction is near by the signs that I'm giving you, and understand these are going to take place during this generation, right then and there. Folks, that generation passed almost 2,000 years ago. And so those events did happen. You remember I told you that destruction of Jerusalem came in AD 70? And that was less than 40 years. 40 years, generation. It happened during that generation that He was speaking of right then. Within the 40-year period, Jerusalem was destroyed. And so the end was not, therefore, the end of time. These signs have nothing to do with the end of time and Christ's second return. It had to do with Christ coming in judgment, not literally, but, well, He literally came in judgment, but not physically in the sense of returning, but bringing this destruction to show He was the King, and their rejection of it was contrary to the will of God. That's what these signs were all about, warning the disciples so that He says, you'll get out of the area and not be harmed when this takes place. And so then the final question. Then are there any signs of Jesus' second coming? I mean, that's a good question. I mean, people talk about it all the time. And so what I wanted you to see is, folks, I have spent a lot of time making sure, meticulously listing every one of the real signs that you can find in the Bible. And I want to examine each one of them carefully so you can see the real signs. And so I want you to look at this list and write them down. Well, here's the list, folks. Right there. That's it. That's not a mistake. My point, hopefully, is there. There are no signs, folks. Don't come as a thief in the night. Thieves don't announce that. They just don't tell you the seasons or the times that they're coming. They don't want you to be aware. And so Jesus says, be prepared. And so, as we conclude, you know, it's interesting. I'm not going to spend much time, but if there really were times and seasons of His return, you know, it's quite interesting. If there was times and seasons revealed of when Christ would set up His kingdom, you know, interestingly enough, in Acts chapter 1, when the disciples asked Jesus about that, you know what He tells them? It's not for you to know the times and the seasons of when God is going to set these things in motion. He said, you don't worry about that. In fact, the very next verse He says, what you need to worry about is the Spirit's going to come and you need to be preaching the gospel, quit speculating and worrying about that kind of stuff. That's what He's telling you. It's not for you to know the times. So the apostles didn't even know the times and seasons. Let me tell you, if they didn't know it, it wasn't for them to know, how in the world could we possibly know today? You just can't. You see. And so in the end, what is our duty? Well, our duty is not to speculate, but to be ready for Christ's return at all times. Let that be a thought that stays in our head. And as we're facing temptation or whatever it is, remember, we do not know when Christ will return. There is no guarantee that you can commit sin or be unfaithful to God today and make it up tomorrow. There's no promise of that. Be ready at all times, serving God, doing what's right, following the statement of Jesus in Luke 12 and verse 40, which says, therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. It's not about the speculation. Oh, He's not coming today. Those who think that, He says, destruction's coming to them. You be ready at all times, because we don't know. There's no way to know. And so the question then concludes, and the lesson concludes with the question, are you ready right now? Are you? There's no signs. There's no means of assuring you that you have even the rest of today, tomorrow, next week, whatever, to get your life right with God. That has to be a choice that you make right now, just as Jesus said. Be ready always. And that begins, if you're outside of Christ, with putting your faith in the Lord, in Jesus as your Savior, as your guide, your one who directs you in your life, putting your life into His hands. That's what faith is all about. And as such, He commands you to repent, to turn change your mind about sin, to turn away from it, because He died to take away sin. Understand the agony, the pain, the sacrifice and love that was there to change your life, to take away your sin. Confessing Jesus as your Lord and Savior. And as a result of that, of understanding the gospel message, you are baptized into Christ, into His death, into His burial, into His resurrection, that you too can be raised up to walk in newness of life, to serve God, as the passage says in Romans 6, as an instrument of righteousness in God's hand. That's what we are to be. That happens through Jesus and the sacrifice there and the grace of God offered to you. If you're subject to the invitation, if you've not lived as you should, why not also, if you came into Christ and you've left, and come back, because you do not know when the Lord will return. If you're subject anyway, the invitation, please come as we stand together and sing.